Okay, so our first speaker is Elizabeth Heath. She's an assistant professor of history at Baruch College, City University of New York. She's author, congratulations, of a book, Wine, Sugar, and the Making of Modern France, Economic Crisis and the Racialization of French Citizenship in 1870-1910, been published just recently by Cambridge University Press. She's currently working on a new project that uses the life stories of colonial commodities to explore the way that imperialism and colonial commerce shape the contours of everyday life in modern France. Her paper today is entitled Visualizing Colonial Trade and Commodities in Early Modern Paris. Elizabeth?
It's really exciting to be here. So I'm going to begin today with a question that has been preoccupying me for a little while, which is, to what extent did empire shape the lives of ordinary people in metropolitan France in the early modern period? Now, historians of the First French Empire have frequently answered this question by making claims about the number of people who earned their living from colonial trade. According to Jacques de Cunha, for example, 1 out of 8 people in 18th century France made their living directly or indirectly from colonial commerce. Others offer slightly modified versions, claiming instead, quote, the livelihood of as many as 1 million of the 25 million inhabitants of France depended directly on colonial trade, or, quote, 1 million metropolitan jobs may have depended on colonial investment. In earlier estimations, Georges Lefebvre deemed colonial commerce considerable and significant in developing a merchant class with revolutionary potential. And Black Jacobin, C.L.R. James, wrote that, quote, nearly all the industries which developed in France during the 18th century had their origin in goods or commodities destined for the coast of Guinea or for America. The total value of the colonies, he estimated, represented 3,000 millions, and on them depended the livelihood of a number of Frenchmen, variously estimated between 2 and 6 million. Now, these kinds of statistics are appealing, and they do provide an answer to the question that has preoccupied me. But they're appealing for historians of the First French Empire for a number of reasons. They provide the kind of pithy fact that rolls easily off the tongue during a lecture, or is easily added to an article. One short sentence says it all. They add a short but effective snapshot of the colonial metropolitan dyad from which much larger claims can be made. However, a brief analysis of the footnotes behind these claims reveals a surprising lack of archival evidence. This is not to say, of course, that the numbers regarding French participation in colonial commerce are made up. Nevertheless, these statistics do seem to circulate in that netherworld of recirculated facts and figures drawn long ago from some credible source, whose archival origins are now a little bit shrouded in mystery. I would argue that these claims linger despite the critical eye of historians everywhere, and I'm sure I'm not the only one who's combed through these footnotes thinking, where are you getting this information? I need it. I would say that they linger on because they offer an easy way to bundle 3 distinct but interrelated claims about the First French Empire in one succinct sentence. The first of these 3 claims is rather obvious. The kinds of statistics purport to establish an absolute economic significance of the French Empire to early modern France, and by extension, I would argue, its relative economic importance vis-a-vis British, Spanish, and Dutch rivals. Second, I would argue these statistics make claims about the importance of empire and colonial trade to the major economic transformations that occurred in France in the 18th century, namely the consumer revolution and the advent of modern industrial capitalism. Finally, I think these statistics connect the empire to the political, intellectual, cultural, and social transformations of the 18th century that paved the path for the French Revolution. How the economic transformation of the 18th century were connected to these larger processes is, of course, a point of debate. But the message inherent in claims about 1 out of 8 or any other variant is clear. No matter how these 2 processes were connected, the empire played a significant role. Clearly, then, claims about the economic importance of the First French Empire cannot be easily tossed aside. They're doing too much intellectual work, though in shorthand. Yet, the fact remains that there is relatively little evidence to back them up. So what to do? Two solutions initially come to mind. The first is to verify the numbers. And it would be easy, I say, tongue-in-cheek, to comb the archives, crunch the numbers, and evaluate the claims. Taking up de Cunha's claims and narrowing it just down to the last four decades leading to the revolution, one would need to find about 12.5% of the population, or about 3 million people, who made their living from colonial commerce. Given that key urban areas involved in colonial trade contained only about 1 million people, and assuming that colonial contact was primarily an urban phenomenon, 1 out of 8 might seem too high. A different approach would be to consider the wide range of professions linked to colonial commerce, directly or indirectly. One could count, among others, the colonial officials, employees of the Ministry of the Marine, the East India Company, and the General Farm. Owners of colonial plantations, no matter where they lived, and Frenchmen and women that lived and worked in the colonies, merchants working in colonial trade and commerce in any capacity, and members of the shipping industry, captains, sailors, shipwrights, etc., especially those affiliated with the shipping industry and ports serving colonial trade, especially the slave trade. And these are only some of the most obvious. Equally important, I would argue, are those people who are less obvious, for they were linked indirectly to colonial trade. In this group, we might include any number of people, such as suppliers of products shipped to the colonies, wine producers, farmers, and makers of hardtack, among others, judges and members of the legal system who enforced trade regulations, doctors who treated patients who had fallen ill with colonial diseases, and dentists, you can see that I've been reading Colin Jones, who examined sugar decayed teeth, and notaries who wrote documents that sustained transoceanic trade. Artisans who worked with colonially derived goods, such as woodworkers who worked with mahogany, violet wood, and other tropical woods, spinners, weavers, dyers, seamstresses, and tailors who worked with colonial cottons or fabric dyed with colonial indigo or cochineal. Keeping up with this approach, we might eventually work through all of the professions in France, including even bandits and tax evaders like Louis Mandarin, who made their living selling colonial products outside of official markets, washerwomen if they cleaned clothes made of colonial cotton, and even rag pickers if they happened to pick up rags made of colonial cottons or dyed with colonial dyes. From this perspective, the percentage of inhabitants linked to colonial commerce was likely large. Colonial enterprises greased the wheels of French commerce, and always great and small. These connections were not exclusively urban. The colonial system reached far into the hinterlands of early modern France. And with this approach, it might actually be easier to identify groups of people who had no contact with the colonies whatsoever than the other way around. Nevertheless, I would argue this quantitative approach has its limits, especially if the more important assertion embedded in claims about the economic importance of the empire has to do with the role of empire in generating new political, economic, cultural, and intellectual processes rather than the actual number of people involved in this trade. This is not to say that the numbers don't count. Rather, it is to argue that the numbers are intended to provide a notion of volume or saturation rather than a precise headcount. Seen in this light, the 1 out of 8, or any other variant, indicates the growing generality of colonial commerce. Moreover, it suggests that colonial commerce did something other than provide a simple sum of money with which individuals paid for rent, food, clothing, or any other necessity or luxury. Rather, the underlying assertion is that connections with colonial commerce and colonial commodities created new ways for individuals to think about wealth and wealth creation. In turn, these ideas generated new ways of thinking about social relations and political authority. Thus, the percentage invoked by 1 out of 8 is meant to suggest the statistical significance of colonial commerce to larger economic, social, political, and intellectual transformations of the period. A growing field of scholarship seems to support the claim that colonial commerce contributed to novel ideas about wealth, consumption, luxury, and legitimate commerce and commercial practices in the 18th century. Much of this work focuses on leading economic theorists and other intellectual elites. Social historical approaches, however, have received significantly less attention, thereby leaving most of the 1 out of 8 still relatively unknown. Getting to their voices and experiences poses a bit of a question. How do we examine how associations with colonial trade and commerce shape the worldview of a non-elite, non-intellectual Parisian or any other Frenchman or woman without reducing them to a number and a statistic or, alternatively, a bullet point in a list? In the short time that I have remaining, I will offer some suggestions about how we can get to the social stratum and realm of everyday life. First, I suggest that we gain some leverage by rethinking the phrase made their living directly or indirectly from colonial trade and substituting with made their lives in small yet significant ways from colonial commerce and commodities instead. Shifting this phrasing from made their living to made their lives is to take an anthropological twist to open a broader way of thinking about economic activity as simultaneously embedded in culture and constitutive of that culture, and the intellectual thoughts and social relations that defined it. Consequently, this reformulation helps to address larger claims about the role of colonial commerce and consumption of colonial commodities in generating new ideas about the status quo and in generating new ideas about being, acting, living, and thinking in early modern France. It also relieves us of the need to provide precise quantitative measure, but to think rather in terms of new forms of economic thought and action becoming socially general. This small yet significant rephrasing thereby opens the door for rethinking about a much wider range of economic activities, the realm of production, the realm of exchange, the realm of circulation, and the realm of consumption. And I certainly do not want to dismiss the importance of labor, or other forms of productive activity, or the realm of exchange, which are the realms focused on by claims about livelihoods and investment. However, ample scholarship has also shown that consumption can be equally important for shaping new patterns of thought and activity. To include the realm of consumption is to say, in short, that people who merely consumed colonial goods were shaped just as much by imperial relations as those who oversaw colonial plantations, armed slave ships, built hogsheads, refined sugar, turned raw cotton into cloth, and varnished mahogany tables. Historians of the French Empire can access all of these experiential realms and the worlds of thoughts that emerged from these activities by focusing on material culture. The world of objects opens new ways to investigate how everyday use of colonial commodities, and by extension, colonial commerce, threw unsuspecting individuals from all walks of life into new habits, bodily actions, and thoughts, in short, new forms of habitus in everyday life, that opened the possibility for economic and political change. Above all, this approach allows an opportunity to investigate the growing generalizability of certain habits and customs, for example, as Julie will talk about, the drinking of coffee at breakfast, and their connections to new forms of subjectivity that have been the focus of recent research on the rise of capitalism. Getting to this realm, of course, is no small feat, but notarial records, bankruptcy records, letters, and diaries offer important entryways into material culture and everyday life. Finally, I will suggest that we can best conceptualize the way that colonial commerce and the new habits and patterns of thought developing around it became socially general by visualizing it. Drawing together the information contained in the notarial records and family papers through GIS, among others, allows us to see the past in new ways. Above all, it offers an understanding of the growing saturation of colonial commerce and relations in everyday life in places like Paris and how colonial influences gradually pervaded the streets of Paris. And so I'm not very accomplished in my work on this GIS project so far, but I can offer you a couple of examples of what I'm thinking about. So the first example over here is a map that I've been working on, which charts out instances in the notarial records where people have gone to the notaries, basically for business transactions having to do with colonial commerce. As well as civil records, marriages, baptismal records, death certificates of somebody who has an affiliation with the colonies, lived in the colonies. And then the final one has to do with slavery. So points where people are buying slaves in the colonies, selling slaves, emancipating slaves, sometimes in their wills. So this is, I would say, a sliver of the material that I found, which I've mapped out here. But the different points are different places where people put their address in the notarial record, so that we can actually start to see places where there's groupings of colonial connections in different neighborhoods. The different colors represent different decades. So I have 1750 to 1790. And my hope is that eventually, as this map is populated, I can fill out the information. But for right now, I have, if you scroll over one of the dots, you should, or click on it. Not, so I have the parishes, but then a red dot or a green dot will give you the notarial record that it came from, as well as just a brief blurb, which I hope to expand so that this would be something that people could actually get a sense of what this what this document tells you about this transaction and the people who are involved with it, what kinds of connections, which colonies they have connections to. The second map that I've been working on, and I did this one really for Julie, is to start to map out some of the colonial businesses located in Paris. So the blue dots all represent cafes or limonadiers who are reported in an almanac from 1790. So it's a little bit late, but this I would say is maybe 5 to 10% of the addresses which are actually listed in this archive. But my hope is to get a sense of how people would move down the street, how pervasive cafes and different places to buy colonial commodities would be. And the final one is very, very rough, but it's trying to figure out what to do with the after-death inventories and to think about how many people in France, what percentage of people in France actually own different forms of colonial goods and how these show up in the inventories and how we can think about how these coffee and sugar infiltrated everyday lives and the kinds of activities that those generated. Right now, I've just done a very simple map, which gives you a sense by parishes of the percentage of inventories which have references to colonial goods. But one could imagine a situation where you start to break that down by household since you have approximation of addresses. So you can see, you know, some neighborhoods have very strong, the darker the color, the stronger the presence of colonial goods. So you also can begin to think about saturation in different neighborhoods that you can break down. So this is all very preliminary, and I will be working on it much more. But my goal ultimately is that by tracing points of colonial commerce and connections, that historians could begin to see how colonial commodities permeated everyday life and linked consumers and producers of all sorts to an imperial system based on slavery. These connections were often subtle, but I would argue not invisible. And in a more advanced version of the study, I ultimately hope to argue that these connections help to cultivate a particular form of double consciousness, a kind of avowal and disavowal of slavery and its role in the emerging society that served as an essential foundation for the emergence of modern capitalism and the modern commodity form. So I'm far from the point of being able to elaborate on this argument now. Nevertheless, I wish to offer the following thoughts by way of conclusion. First, I would argue that GIS and new forms of digital humanities can offer the tools for new kinds of regime change by which we take old, long-accepted facts and develop new ways of interrogating them and developing the claims implicit within them. Digital humanities also offers new opportunity to publish and share these findings. In embracing these technologies, 1 out of 8 can not only be rethought and rephrased, but the research it generates can provide a trip down the streets of Paris and an entryway into some of the homes that line these streets. It also creates the possibility for mapping the complicated networks that link slave laborers in the colonies to Parisian breakfast tables and how these tenuous ties provided the foundation for revolutionary change. Thank you.